Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Brittany Friedman on the show. Dr. Friedman is a sociologist and expert on cover-ups, politics, and the dark side of institutions. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. Friedman's research has appeared in the Washington Post, NPR, The Nation, Jacobin Magazine, and the Associated Press, among others. She is a co-founder of the Creative Money Lab and affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation. She has come on to discuss her new book, Carceral Apartheid, How Lies and White Supremacists Run Our Prison. Here's the description. It is impossible to deny the impact of lies and white supremacy on institutional conditions in U.S. prisons. There's a particular power dynamic of racist intent in the prison system that culminates in what Dr. Friedman terms carceral apartheid. Prisons are a microcosm of how carceral apartheid operates as a larger governing strategy to decimate political targets and foster deceit, disinformation, and division in society. Among many shocking discoveries, Dr. Friedman shows that beginning in the 1950s, California prison officials declared war on imprisoned black people and sought to identify black militants as a key problem, creating a strategy for the management, segregation, and elimination of these individuals from the prison population that continues to the present day. Carceral Apartheid delves into how the California Department of Corrections deployed various official, clandestine, and at times extra-legal control techniques, including officer alliances with imprisoned white supremacists, to suppress black political movements, revealing the broader themes of deception, empire, corruption, and white supremacy in American mass incarceration. Drawing from original interviews with founders of black political movements such as the Black Guerrilla Family, white supremacists, and a swath of little-known archival data, Dr. Friedman uncovers how the U.S. domestic war against imprisoned black people models and perpetuates genocide, imprisonment, and torture abroad. This was a fascinating and at times wonky conversation, and one that I know you'll love. Let's go meet Dr. Brittany Friedman. I've interviewed a couple sociologists on this podcast before, and I wanted to ask you specifically because it's something that I think about a lot. I'm a librarian, and I recently received funding to update our nonfiction collections in our library. And I was going through the boxes that we received in the sociology section, and it's such a broad range. It feels like sociology is almost a catch-all these days. So for you, what is sociology? What's its parameters? And how has it become such a big tent? It's an amazing resource, but it's also hard to define.
So I think, Jordan, that's a very good point. And I chuckled to myself when I heard your question, because sociology is a very big field. And it's just because society is huge, right? The questions that we could ask are very big. And so for me, sociology broadly is the study of society. Specifically, we specialize in social groups and looking at patterns and trying to understand, do certain patterns tend to order the world, for lack of a better term? Can we make predictions, if you will, based on what we have learned in the past in terms of how patterns structure people's behavior, how they structure society? And so for that reason, that's a very big topic. And so sociologists, we all have our corners of the discipline where we are specialists, and that can be either in terms of a specific topic, such as studying prisons, or it can also be a specific method. Whereas for me, I'm a qualitative sociologist, which means that I use methods that try to understand close patterns of people by observing people, by doing interviews, and by doing archival research, versus doing something that is more hands-off, like surveys or statistical regressions.
So is that what you mean when you use the term investigative sociology, or are you referring to something additional?
So when I use the term investigative sociology, it's actually a term, to my knowledge, that I have coined. So I have not heard anyone else use the term, and I have had people asking me constantly, can I see a copy of your book? Because in the methods section, I know you're talking about investigative sociology and what that means. And so for me, investigative sociology means that you are specifically wearing the hat of an investigator, almost like an investigative journalist. And so you're going in with questions that are going to require you to dig deeper, to look beyond what we can traditionally observe as sociologists. So for example, if I'm an ethnographer, I can go into a public space and observe and take notes and try to look for patterns in people's behavior. But if you're an investigative sociologist, oftentimes what you want to know is going to be the answer to a question that is very difficult to uncover. And so that is what I specialize in, is uncovering data so that we can actually better see the social problem that we're studying. And for me, I'm very passionate about that because I think that too often we rely on easier ways of collecting data in the social sciences. But for example, if we're studying a government and we are only relying on their public testimonies, how will we know the ways in which politicians are truly making decisions if we're not actually investigating their backroom conversations or their interpersonal connections beyond the public sphere? And so that's what investigative sociology is for me. And that's why I am pushing that as an area of research.
Okay. The other thing you discuss often is translating sociology into narrative. And I think there's probably costs and benefits to that. The benefits being it becomes part of a story, people conceptualize it. That one of the challenges I see is when details don't comport with the direction of the narrative, how you integrate those in a way that still makes sense of a story as opposed to an array of data points on a scatter plot, if you will. So can you talk to us a little bit about translating sociology into narrative?
So I think that it's important to translate sociology into narrative because, for example, when people are reading data points and people are reading the findings of a social scientific study, oftentimes people don't fully remember what they have read. This is something I have seen not just with my students, but I have seen just in conversations with people. And when I ask them, what are the books and what are the articles that you really remember the argument and it stayed with you? And it's the type of argument that you brought with you to like a dinner conversation, for example, or a coffee conversation. And they will generally tell me examples when scholars are using stories and narratives to make empirical points. And it's because those stories and the people in the stories for the audience, they almost become characters, but not in a dehumanizing way. They become characters in a sense that people can remember the story and they can usually identify, maybe not with all aspects of the character, but with some aspects. Similar to when we consume fiction books, when we consume novels, or when we consume television shows or movies. I think that there's something about having very relatable vignette as the tool through which you explain an empirical factual point that you have evidence to back up. I think that is the best way to teach people versus throwing numbers at them, and the people don't necessarily absorb information in that way. And I've learned that as a teacher, but also as a writer.
One of the things you talk about and mention as an area of expertise is cover-ups. I want to ask you what you mean by that and how you distinguish between conspiracies and general incompetence, which I guess is another way of asking about the role of intent and how you discern that.
So a cover-up is when there is an intentional effort to hide the truth, to hide information, to conceal. And there's a lot of different techniques that people and institutions use to intentionally hide information. And so this can be incredibly obvious. So things like institutional gaslighting and making it seem like the reality that victims and witnesses experience isn't true. And for example, so with institutions, we often can see this in press releases where they will spin a narrative, but it's done very intentionally to cover up the reality of harm. And I think cover-ups are very important in the study of sociology because cover-ups bring us to a point of not shying away from intentionality. Because oftentimes as sociologists, when we're trained that there's these magical unintended consequences that happen because of the way that society is arranged. But when you focus on cover-ups like I do, and when you engage in investigative sociology, you are often met with very clear evidence of lying. And so in my own research, because it happened over time in terms of starting as a graduate student and over time becoming a more senior scholar, when you encounter lying enough at the institutional level and you can see different actors engaging in this behavior because you have the evidence, right? You have the memo that they wrote or the email versus what they've said publicly. You begin to realize, wow, we really don't have a complete picture when we just make these data requests from institutions and organizations and we just take them at their word for what they've said. And so I think that's the difference between a cover-up and a conspiracy is the data, is that you actually have proof to show that a concealment has occurred and that there are lies. And that there is a concerted effort to make this happen. It's not like an unintended consequence or a collateral consequence.
Okay. Last kind of table setting question here. Lately, I've been doing this fun thing, which I haven't done since graduate school, which is reread a lot of the kind of the Marxist and critical theory literature that I read throughout grad school, like books like History and Class Consciousness, for example. And it's been interesting to go back to it, I don't know, almost 10 years later after grad school. And what do you see for you, the role of praxis in your work? It felt like that was embedded when I was reading the text, that there was an element of praxis here, but can you unpack that for us?
Yes, absolutely. And because praxis is such a big word, can you clarify for me how you're using it?
Oh, I'm just using it connecting theory to action.
Got it. So I, in terms of my own political beliefs or the beliefs of those that I am showing in the book?
I guess I'll let you answer how you'd like. It felt like your book had some embedded calls to action, if you will.
Yes. So I would say for me, I think that often we're put in situations, scholars like myself who do investigative work, who do what I call investigative sociology or investigative social science. Because of this work, we're often met with having very clear evidence of institutional misconduct, of abuse, of torture, of civil rights violations. And so as a scholar, I think that puts you in an ethical dilemma, right? So you can make a decision. Am I going to just write up my findings and publish an article or publish an essay or publish a book like I have and then just go about my merry way and pretend like I didn't see what I saw? Or am I going to write something that is factual? And then I'm also going to make it clear that some things in our world that we discover through data are just wrong. You cannot make an argument that there's two sides to the story. And so I think that for me, when writing this book, I decided that because I discovered the intentionality of the Department of Corrections and prison officials, that I wasn't going to shy away from a tone of voice in the book that makes it clear what they were doing. And so I think that can be read almost as me putting forth a call to action. But I think a lot of it is that I didn't want to sugarcoat what they did and what I could show that they did. And so that's why also I conclude in the book, after you've read all of this, as one reviewer called the book a genealogy of a murder, among other things. And he said he wasn't able to put the book down because of this, because I was documenting so many things that he was just, I can't believe this, even as someone who studies incarceration. And so I think because of that, I didn't want to leave people hanging. And so the conclusion of the book does offer, in a poetic sense, an invitation to think through, based on everything that I've shown you, is this the world that we want to continue? continue to live in? Is this the world that we want to create for our own descendants? And how can we create differently? And I end on that note because I want people to really think about it for themselves.
Okay. Let's jump to what I'm calling the historiography of incarceration in prisons. And we're going to start with a wide lens and then get narrow. Why do you think and this is a layered question before I ask it, why do you think the United States incarcerates so many people? And how do you think historically that's been answered? And how does your perspective differ?
So I think historically that question has been answered where scholars have shown that the United States incarcerates so many people because first and foremost, we have adopted a very Puritan-based notion of punishment, of right and wrong, but also the United States has prized itself on a deterrence model, which is actually coming from, and I talk about this in the chapter of my book on adjusting problem inmates, the rise of deterrence theory in the United States. And that's very much coming from classical criminological thought. And that for hundreds of years was thought to be, what is the term, evidence-based. But what's interesting about that is that while the United States has prized itself on being a country that engages in punishment policies that are rooted in scientific inquiry, at the same time, we're a country that punishes people based on moral panics. And what I mean by that is that each generation has their population of people that are deemed by the government, local and state and federal governments, as being public enemy number one. And so scholars have made that argument that incarceration is used as a tool to label those populations as not belonging, as being a threat to the American dream, and then they are arrested and incarcerated to remove them. And so that kind of gets me into the scholarly arguments that incarceration is so high in the United States because it is an extension of the colonial empire that the United States has wielded against indigenous people, against people of African descent that were brought as enslaved peoples, and then also against Latinx peoples who were also systematically removed as a part of manifest destiny or who were subsumed into the population. And so historically, these are a lot of the, I would say, traditional and critical. I gave a quick overview of scholarly arguments as to why the United States incarcerates so many people. And I think what I add to that conversation is I am emphasizing the imperial aspect of that, the fact that we are the world's greatest empire, the world's most violent empire. And I'm really showing and emphasizing that when we say that, I'm not just saying that about the United States internationally. I'm talking about domestically. The United States as a nation, as a government, has committed horrendous atrocities against predominantly people of color, and then against working class people of all races on the basis of imperial expansion. And so I show that in my book as really being the backdrop of why what happened in the California prison system should not be a surprise. Even though when people read things, they are surprised. I'm arguing that if we believe that the United States is a violent empire and that our country has a bloody history and that's why we exist as we do, then everything I say in the book would be plausible that it would happen, that it would need to happen, because the prison is very much a replication of what happens in free society.
The book I'm referencing now is a popular book. It's not, I wouldn't classify it in the kind of academic category, but it has shaped a lot of people's perceptions around incarceration. I'm obviously referring to the new Jim Crow. What do you think the biggest point of departure between your perspective and Alexander's perspective in that book?
I think the biggest point of departure is that my book is very much emphasizing how the extra legal arm of punishment is absolutely necessary for the traditional ways of punishment that we see to exist. And so what I mean by that is traditionally we think of punishment, and as we see in the new Jim Crow, which she very, you know, excellently describes and argues in that great book, that she documents the racist impacts and underpinnings of, for example, from chattel slavery to arrest to incarceration, and how this is connected in a historical sense. And what I'm trying to show in my book is that those types of arguments are necessary, but they're very much emphasizing the most obvious and obvious aspects of the criminal justice system that we can see. What my book is doing is showing the aspects of the criminal justice system that are more difficult to see. For example, the extra legal aspects, the aspects such as arming white supremacists that eventually form the Aryan Brotherhood and having them do hits against incarcerated Black people that are deemed dangerous, which very much mirrors what the police were doing on the outside at the same time with the Klan, for example, and aligning with the Klan so that members of the civil rights movement would be executed. And so my book is emphasizing this hidden extra legal component as being just as important, or almost, I would say, actually more important than the very obvious aspects of the criminal justice system that are abusive.
Okay. I want to ask you about some institutional stuff now. Having had some interactions with the bureaucracy of CDCR, I can imagine it was incredibly complicated to do research. And so I would love for you to share about a little bit about the challenges of writing prison histories in source materials and working with the institutions. And then the second part to the question is, how do you think, based on what you read through the archives, CDCR perceives itself?
I love that question, especially the second part. So it made me smile in a sarcastic way. But I think, so one, I would say for me, the greatest challenge that I faced in doing this research for this book, which took me over a decade to do the research necessary and to write this book. And I think the biggest challenge that I faced was just there was a lot of fear. And what I mean by that is once I was able to get access to archival records that I never thought I was going to be able to get access to, there's just a sense of fear as what's going to happen to me if I make this public, or what just the impending doom feeling of this is so egregious that if I move forward with this, like, is something bad going to happen? And I say that because even leading up to this book being written, I have received hateful emails before after doing interviews. I have received weird text messages and I changed my phone number. It's something that is real and that happens. I don't know if it happens as much to scholars, but definitely to investigative journalists. So that's why I go back to that point of, like, when you're, as an investigative sociologist, when you're uncovering harm that's been done by powerful institutions, I think it is normal to feel afraid. And I think for good reason. I think also a lot of this fear came from the fact that some of the archival materials that I was able to access, I had to copy down by hand, which I talk about in the book. And I was being watched the entire time by the archivists, which gives you this, it felt very much like a Foucauldian panopticon, because I'm sitting there taking all these notes and I'm a grad student and I'm just like, this is not a good feeling. Like, why are they watching me? It's not paranoia. These are real things that happened to me. And I remember when I first started doing interviews with members and founders of the Black Gorilla family, like, my phone started beeping. And I remember they would be like, are you recording me? And I was like, that's not me. That's my phone beep. And I would just like, I would chuckle and be like, my phone beeps now. It's been, and so to say things like that, you normally don't hear professors talking like that. Again, you hear it from journalists, but I just think that let me know that I was onto something in my work, and that I was going to have to go around the Department of Corrections, right? Because the Department of Corrections is not going to tell me what I want to know if I'm asking things that could put them in a bad light. Yeah.
Let's jump into the title of the book, because there's a lot of allusions and historical, I would say embedded historical meaning to using the word carceral apartheid. Can you unpack that for us? What you're meaning and what you're not meaning by using that term?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think infamously, apartheid is a system of racial separation, a system of racial warfare, arguably, and economic extraction. And the term is often applied when we're thinking about South Africa. Sociologists, about I think the first edition of that book maybe came out like a couple decades ago, wrote a book with apartheid in the title, talking about the creation of what they termed to be the American ghetto. And that kind of set a precedence for the term apartheid to be used with regard to the United States. And then also, apartheid is used as a term often too when we think about colonialism and extraction and so settler colonialism in particular in Israel and Palestine. And it is a term that is often used as well when talking about what we're witnessing today. So I think for me, using the term is very powerful because I'm trying to show that, look, scholars have written about apartheid in South Africa. They've written about apartheid in Palestine and even about apartheid in the United States. But why aren't we talking about how apartheid infiltrates the ways that prisons are governed as well? Because prisons are not there, scholars have shown, going all the way back to Goffman and writing about total institutions and all different theories of prisons, prisons are porous. And they're not just these places on islands that are not impacted by governing strategies that are happening outside of them. And so that's why I chose apartheid, is because I'm trying to take a clear stance that we cannot overlook the impact of apartheid on prisons. And we can't think that it's over and that it's gone. Because I think if you go to certain neighborhoods in the United States, I think if you did interviews with residents of those neighborhoods, what they would describe to you would sound like apartheid. And we would people who, but people who don't live in those neighborhoods, who don't even know of them, wouldn't even have that notion. And I think the same thing goes for prisons. It's as I was doing my work for this book, and I was interviewing people and analyzing the archival data, I was like, this is our apartheid. Like, I don't need to shy away from using this visceral term because it is what I'm seeing. And as I said, it's still happening today. I do have a line in with what's happening in present time in California prisons. And my book, unfortunately, I don't know if my book will ever become dated if we don't change things.
I want to talk a little bit about the difference between de facto and de jure apartheid. I think there's a popular understanding that segregation and apartheid that exists in prisons just corresponds to the composition of gangs, segregation that exists within society. What's wrong with that perspective?
I think what's wrong with that perspective is that it has the energy of believing that apartheid is acceptable in some situations. And I think that what I show in my book is that oftentimes e that there is a there is it's not as though incarcerated people are just self-selecting into different racial groups or into different prisoner organizations. I think what I show very convincingly is that when incarcerated people try to see beyond race, the institution doesn't let them. And it doesn't let them in very deliberate ways. And it's not just official policies such as segregating people or housing people on the basis of race or categorizing people in that way. It's also correctional officers going over to, for example, the white population in a particular institution and spreading rumors that the black population is going to attack them. And the impact that has is to continue the interpersonal apartheid between incarcerated people. And so I try to show and document these instances across decades to really make the argument that it is a through line, and that we have to, when we are thinking about apartheid, we have to think about how its different manifestations are ultimately in service of preventing unity. The goal of apartheid overall is very clear, I think, in the case that I'm showing and in the case of and all of the other cases that I described earlier in with the previous scholarship on other countries and the United States, is that the goal of apartheid is to prevent unity on the basis of race or religion or ethnicity, and to create separation. Even when people express or try to unite themselves around commonalities that we all have as human beings, you see this very deliberate effort on the part of law enforcement and governments and officials to prevent that. And so I think a even better question is, why are they trying to prevent that so intentionally?
There's not been as many popular histories of eugenics in California as I wish there was. It's a history that I think some people know about maybe opaquely, but can't really describe with anything specific. And that's just a segue for me to talk about a character in your book, Dr. Leo Stanley. So can you explain to us what were undesirables, and can you connect some of his work in CDC, because I don't believe there was an R by this point, with the broader project of eugenics in California?
Yeah, absolutely. Leo Stanley, writing about him was incredibly difficult, but at the same time, I know that there's some historiography on Stanley, which I do cite in the book, but there's not as much as there should be. And as you say, like, he fits very strongly in the history of eugenics in California, and he's not publicly known, except for the, I would argue, the propaganda that the Department of Corrections puts forth about him, which I do talk about in the book. But basically, he was the chief surgeon of San Quentin for several decades. He began in the early 20th century, and he's a part of this movement that's happening in society at the time amongst scientists, amongst politicians, amongst social reformists, that there are people in society that are undesirable in terms of we don't want them to reproduce, especially, and we want to be able to contain them. And what makes them undesirable, it could be their race. So eugenics is inherently, it's a white supremacist policy. It could be their race. It could be their religion. And so eugenics has historically also been incredibly anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, anti-Buddhist, pretty anything that is considered outside of the Christian imaginary. And he's a part of this movement. And in his role as the chief surgeon of San Quentin, he is pretty much given free rein to test his theories on how can we fix these undesirable populations, because he has a whole host of incarcerated people who are inmates that he can test the theories on. Because at the time, inmates are considered the quintessential undesirable, right? Someone who is incarcerated, the belief was that they have some physiological flaw that led to their criminality and some psychiatric flaw. And so Stanley is bringing that knowledge because he's trained as a medical doctor, but he's also very interested in sociology, which is still, it's growing as a discipline at the time. So he's very interested in sociology. He's very interested in psychology versus psychiatry. And he wants to see if he can blend all of this scientific knowledge to come up with the perfect cure. And he's very important because he is responsible for institutionalizing this eugenicist ethos into the Department of Corrections.
So one of the interesting things that came up, and my God, this has an Orwellian ring to it, was these adjustment centers. What was their intended function and goal?
So the adjustment centers are a continuation of Leo Stanley's vision that the California Department of Corrections can be the premier government agency that is fixing the undesirables of California, and that what we do in California can be exported across the nation, and then eventually, hopefully, across the globe. And so the adjustment centers, they come about first in 1953. Granted, Leo Stanley, he retires in 1951. And so in 1953, there's been a two-year gap. Prison officials in Sacramento, they start trading memos and talking about they're disillusioned because what are we going to do with all of these undesirables? And many of the people they're talking about, they had at the time categorized them as psychotic or having like severe deformities. And this is their language. So they put together a committee on intensive cases, on the treatment of intensive cases, what they called it in the archives. And they were like, maybe we can create these separate units where we can adjust them. And so then they called the centers adjustment centers or adjustment units, and that each prison could have their own adjustment center where people who had been identified by staff as being undesirable, as needing adjustment, could go to these centers and they could be cured. They could be cured by a team of doctors like the once great Leo Stanley in the minds of prison officials. They could be or cured through different bouts of isolation combined with psychiatric and social treatment. And so adjustment centers are key in my book, and it's why I dedicated an entire chapter to them, because there is very little historiography on adjustment centers, which is why I felt like it was my duty to write that chapter and really write a chapter about the history, because not just because of how important they are for the later chapters in my book, but also because the adjustment centers, they are this continuation of Leo Stanley. They set the precedence for the abuse of incarcerated people in California to become official policy, even more so beyond Leo Stanley. And so that's why I trace them, to show that it's not a few renegade correctional officers that are doing these quote unquote bad things, like there's these bad apples. It's no, the entire tree of the Department of Corrections is rotten. And here's an example to show you why, that there are official policies such as the adjustment center, which would disappear people for months, up to years, in basically just idle isolation, not receiving the quote unquote treatments that were promised. And if they were receiving treatments, it's very much akin to being tortured. So being beaten, people describe sexual assault, different types of abuse. And the adjustment center, it is a horrendous example in our history of institutionalizing eugenics and institutionalizing faulty science as a means of quote unquote rehabilitating people, but really destroying people. And years later, the Department of Corrections added rehabilitation to their name. And it's just very interesting, because I think that's truly how they see themselves. That's what they were arguing that they were doing all the way back in the 1950s with the Adjustment Center. And that's what they argued they were doing as early as 1905 with Dr. Leo Stanley. Like, it's the most horrible things that I document in this book. A lot of it was done under the public announcement that we're rehabilitating people, we're fixing people. And that's an important point, I think, for readers to take away.
Let's jump to Black activists and militants in CDCR. Can you discuss the origins of the concern about their presence within the prison system and then the tactics used to identify them?
Yes. So the origin of the concerns for people who were active or who were interested or suspected of having interest in Black social movements on the outside of prison, especially, really begins, at least in the archival record that I was able to uncover. I was able to go back as far as the 1950s. And what I found was hard evidence that the Department of Corrections and prison officials in Sacramento were basically very concerned about the Nation of Islam at the time. That is what their biggest kind of preoccupation was. They saw the Nation of Islam as the epitome of what was wrong with the civil rights movement at the time. And so they began to develop official policies to identify and segregate and remove anyone that they could flag as being associated with the Nation of Islam, and to lock them away in adjustment centers. And this is important because at this time, when this is happening in the late 50s and early 60s, the adjustment centers start to go through an ideological shift. So at first, they're conceived of as these centers for people who are labeled as psychotic, who are going to be readjusted. But as we see in less than a decade, like it's like within 5 years, actually, the shift from this notion that people who are undesirable or problematic are psychotic to those who are considered political and behavioral problems. And the Nation of Islam was the first group that was officially targeted. And so you see this very important shift in the label of who's considered undesirable. And another important point is that this label would follow people even after their incarceration. And so the Division of Probation and Parole was sent a list of names. Like, these are people that we identified and that we have targeted and we have segregated. And so it becomes something that follows people even into society if they're released, which makes it very dangerous for them in terms of their interactions with law enforcement on the outside. Because we can, and we can think to, for example, incidents in California, such as the Watts riots. This kind of targeting and naming, then it expands beyond the Nation of Islam when the Department of Corrections starts to realize, actually, we need to identify anyone who is even close to any sort of political movement that is Black. And so the list grows from not just the Nation of Islam, but to anyone suspected of subversive activity. And so that's when they start to really hone in on this notion of the Black militant being a problem.
One thing that I was a little bit surprised about in your book is that the name Ronald Reagan wasn't in it. He came to office in the mid-60s as the governor of California, funded and with the ideas, fringe right ideas, as part of his platform, if you will. Why did you not choose to include his role in shaping the politics around prisons and how we label people?
Because I feel like a lot of really great books have already done that history. I think for me, it's there were versions of the book that kind of that talk about him and situate how does he fit within what I'm talking about. But I felt like it was more detracting from the end goal of my book was to really show you the inner workings of the Department of Corrections. And I think that it was a decision I made because I feel like I have a long list of books by many by colleagues that I can say, this is the book to read if you want to learn about how Reagan really shaped California. But I feel like now, if people really want to understand then what happened inside the prisons during these time periods, during the war on poverty, during the eventual war on crime and war on drugs, then they will read my book.
How did activists and militants use the court systems to fight separation and apartheid?
The Nation of Islam was actually at the forefront of filing several lawsuits against the Department of Corrections. And when we look at the prisoners' rights movement in the United States more broadly, the Nation of Islam is just very much, I would say, one of the most active groups. And in California, it's no different. Even though I show instances in my book, I give examples of how the Nation of Islam is basically trying to fight back and how they're squashed in different ways. But truthfully, they were very much a role model. And people also told me that in their interviews, people that eventually co-founded the Black Guerrilla Family, they said the Nation of Islam was a role model for us because they were never afraid to fight back. They weren't afraid to fight back in the prison itself, and they also weren't afraid to fight back in the courts.
I want to talk about the goals largely. And I think this can touch on a few different domains. Let's take a 50,000 foot perspective for a moment. In your concluding chapter, you discuss abolition. What for you does that look like in California?
For me, what that looks like in California is there's a lot of different ways and steps that we could go about it. I think first and foremost, what's important is redirecting our funding. Because even though I don't talk about it in this book, there just wasn't room to do that. In my other research, a big part of my work is looking at how money flows and funding and politics play a significant role in the lasting use of prisons in our society. And so I think that we have to address the economic role that prisons play. And so what do I mean by that? For example, one area that I study is how courts and how police departments and how prisons use fines and fees to charge people who are ensnared in the system as a source of revenue. And if we want to, for example, abolish that system, the first pushback that we always get from lawmakers when having these conversations and doing presentations is then, how are we going to fund the court? Or how are we going to fund our department? How are we going to fund? A lot of that money also goes to public expenditures. So lawmakers will say, we actually use the money from those prison fines to pay for new roads. So how are we going to do that? So I think that for me, that question just opens up a door to thinking about, for me, first and foremost, how do we fund a society that prioritizes life, that prioritizes freedom, education, and health? And how do we do that without relying economically on prisons and jails and police departments? Because I think people who even agree with the moral argument of why we should have alternatives to incarceration, I think it what stops them, especially if they're a lawmaker and they're dealing with budgets and taxpayer dollars, is then how are we going to pay for all these other things?
What do you make and what do you think about experiments like Gavin Newsom is trying outside of Chowchilla with employing Scandinavian models of incarceration? The idea that you spend more dollars on teachers and training programs and less dollars on more correctional officers, bars, those kinds of things. Do you feel like that is progress in some way, or do you think that's maybe an illusion of progress?
You know, I think that's a difficult question because on the one hand, I definitely want to argue for, you know, if we're going to keep people incarcerated, I want to argue for better conditions. But on the other hand, I want to argue that we don't keep people in cages at all and that we find other ways to handle harm. We find other ways to intervene much earlier, right? Much earlier in life before the harm would ever take place. So I think that a successful model of abolition in California is doing both.
Okay.
To be honest, I really think it's doing both. I think it's changing our conditions and trying different models that have been shown in the academic literature and the policy literature to be better for human beings. But I also think that we, again, to my point, we need to match that with how do we no longer rely so much, especially in terms of our funding, on the criminal justice system to generate revenue from people that are arrested or that are incarcerated.
I ask all my guests this question. I like them to take what particular research that they've done and pull it back and ask them how that shapes how they see the history of the state. So how has conducting this research, writing this book, changed the way you see the history of the state of California?
It has made it even clearer for me that the history of California as we know it has been written in a way that obscures the true harms that our society was built upon. Writing this book, writing Carceral Apartheid, has taught me that if we don't practice truth-telling as method, as a way of excavating information, as a way of showcasing where lies reside, then we will never know the true history of where we live, of the land that we now call home. It just really taught me the importance of fact-checking, the importance of considering whose history, so who wrote this history, what is their own political agenda, how can we put them in perspective? These are all things that I did in my book when I come across sources, right? I don't just take the source at face value. I triangulate the source, which basically literally means almost creating a triangle where I figure out where the source came from. Does the source match with other sources that are different? This whole process of checking. And I think that has become so important to me. It's important to how I see the world and how I see our state. I'm constantly thinking, if this history was written, for example, in 30, 40, 50 years ago, is it worth revisiting? Because maybe we were living in a time culturally where it wasn't acceptable to speak out publicly about certain things. But I think now more than ever, we are in a time where it is safer to just say what is true, even if you're scared.
We're going to close with my favorite section as a librarian. It is always book recommendations. So either based on your research or other areas of interest of yours, what are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I think that's a really great question. And I want to make sure, especially because you said you're going to edit it, I don't want to forget a book.
It's always a scattershot. So just whatever's up top of your mind. It doesn't have to be the Brittany Freeman's Western canon, if you will. It could just be whatever you want to include.
So a book that I really love is by Reuben Miller, and the book is called Halfway Home. And the subtitle is Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. And the reason I love this book is because the poetic prose of this book just very much inspired me. They also made me feel like it was safe to write in that way and not really care what other people think. And I just think the care with which he takes to describe and talk about the people that he got to know in his book, I think is just very commendable. And I think it shows a way of doing work that is very much human-centered. And so for those reasons, I love that book. And I think a lot of other people love it because Reuben ended up winning the MacArthur Genius Award a few years later after that book came out. So I think he very much is someone that deserves that award because that book is brilliant.
All right, let's close with talking about what are you working on next?
I'm very excited about that question because I am currently working on another study of cover-ups. But this time, I am currently developing a survey to ask people questions to help understand the ways that people see cover-ups, how they understand them, if people feel like they have experienced a cover-up or been a part of one, and just really try to understand on a broader level, right? Like, how do people see this term? Do people feel like they're experiencing cover-ups in their personal lives or their professional lives? And like an example of this is I have a question about things as personal as, have you ever experienced an affair, right? Because if we're thinking about it sociologically, an affair is a type of cover-up. It's an interpersonal cover-up. And so I'm very excited about that project because it's broader and I'm just so interested in seeing what people say once this survey launches.
I'll be excited to read it. Thank you so much for talking with us. The book again is Carceral Apartheid, How Lies and Right Supremacists Run Our Prisons. Dr. Friedmans, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much, Jordan. I really appreciate it. And thank you everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.